Okay, it looks like the class is together. Rabbi Hillman, with your permission, shall we begin? Good evening, everyone. And regards from beautiful downtown Elkanah. It's raining in Israel now in May. Tropical heat and rain. It's weather we've never had before here. But it's beautiful. It's Eretz Israel. What could be best? All right, we're back in Perek HaMakid. And if you recall, at the end of last week's episode, we had completed the study of the first sugya on the Amoraic level, and we were beginning to discuss the level of the Stamma de Gemara, the Shakta Vitarya, which amplifies on the Amoraic level in the sugya. And we did the first component of the Stamma, that is, component number 2 bet, as an example of how the Stamma amplifies on the words of the Amora Rami Barchama. What I'd like to do today is let's finish the Stamma de Sugya segments of this first Sugya, and then we're going to go on to the second Sugya, which is quite a fascinating piece. If you recall, in component number 4 and number 5 in the first Sugya, Rabbi Zeira attacks the words of Rava, his teacher, and says that Rava's principle of retroactivity to the point of the pikadon, the point of the guardianship, beginning of the guardianship, cannot be true, because if it were true, then all of the fleece and all of the progeny born by the animal being guarded over the period of the guardianship would, in effect, belong to the guardian, since retroactively he was the owner from the beginning of that point. And we know that there's a brayta that says, chutz migizoteha uvaldoteha, which is component 4 bet, and therefore Rava's construction has to be false. Rabbi Zeira then makes an amendment to Rava's statement, and he says that what Rava meant was that the retroactivity to the moment of the beginning of the guardianship specifically excludes the fleece and the offspring, and therefore does not contradict the brayta. That's Rabbi Zeira's contribution. And then, in component number 6 Aleph and 6 Bet, the Stamma de Gemara slips in a comment asking, why is it that an owner would be so willing to give up double, quadruple, or even quintuple damages coming from a thief, but would be not willing to give up the fleece and the offspring coming from the animal itself? And the Gemara asks in 6 Aleph, my psaka, what's the logic here of this psak that the guardianship does not include rights to the fleece and the offspring? And the Stamma answers in component 6 bet, Stamma de Milta, Shvacha de Atame Alma Avid Enash de Makne, Shvacha de Migufa Lo Avid Enash de Makne, that a person may be willing to give up those kinds of benefits that come from outside the animal, such as the double, the quadruple, or the quintuple damages. But no one is going to be willing to give up those benefits that come from inside the animal, from the animal himself, because he knows that those are coming. He relies on them. And therefore, there's no reason why he should give them up. What is the function of this piece of Stamma de Gemara? It's coming to explain why it is that Rabbi Zeira was so intent to exclude Gizoteha uvaldoteha from Rava's retroactivity formula. And we, of course, have to ask here, does the Stamma de Gemara here present Rabbi Zeira's thought, or does it present a speculation as to why Rabbi Zeira could have said what he said? And this is a problem that we have straight through all of Shas when the Stamma de Gemara does an okimta, a conceptual okimta in the words of an amora, that we don't know whether the okimta is shot, that is the okimta saying what the amora really meant to think and meant to say, or is the okimta representing a speculative suggestion of the Stamma, what the amora possibly could have meant. And we're going to run into this problem over and over and over again with okimta, both of okimta of the amoraim by the Stamma, and okimta of the tanaim by the amoraim. There is also, of course, okimta of the Torah by the Tanaim in Midrash Halakha and in Mishnah, but we won't get into that this time. Let's take a look at the last Stamma component of our sugya, which is in component number 8. And in component number 8, the Gemara is relating to the two nuschaot in the Memra of Rava, the first having been presented in component number 3, and the second in component number 7. In component number 3, Rava's principle of retroactivity goes back to the first point of the guardianship, and that brought us into Rabbi Zeira's question and answer. But the second nusach in Rava's retroactivity principle, presented in component number 7, is that the retroactivity takes effect only to 1 minute before the theft. And therefore, it obviates, of course, Rabbi Zeira's question, because there is no issue whatsoever of the fleece and the offspring in the minute before the theft takes place. The Gemara, in component number 8, asks in 8 Aleph, my Beinaihu, what is the practical halakhic difference between the two nuschaot of Rava's retroactivity theory? And the answer is dual. In 8 Aleph 1, we have Kushiyad Rabbi Zeira, that is, according to the first version of Rava's retroactivity theory, Rava can be challenged by Rabbi Zeira, and Rabbi Zeira's answer would be relevant. But according to the second opinion of Rava, that the retroactivity takes place only the minute before the theft, then that would not help us. And therefore, the Gemara suggests a second nafkamina, a second practical differentiation between the two opinions, and that is iname de kaimaba agam, that at the moment that the animal was stolen by the thief, the animal happened to be standing in a swamp or in an undeveloped area outside the ownership of the guardian. And therefore, if it was standing in the swamp, the guardian would be unable to attain ownership of the animal 1 minute before the theft, because the animal is standing in a place over which the guardian has no control, and his acquisition cannot take effect. And therefore, according to the second opinion of Rava, that the retroactivity is going to take place 1 minute before the theft, then we have a problem if the animal is not in the direct control of the guardian at that time. What is the purpose of this third component of the Stamat de Gemara, component number 8? Its purpose is, and this appears everywhere in the Gemara, again, to speak on a level of method for a moment, any time that the Gemara has two different versions of a given statement, or two different opinions relating to a given thing, the Gemara will ask, my Beinaihu, what is the practical difference between them? Because, after all, our purpose is to understand halakha lema'aseh, what is the meaning of what we're learning. And therefore, that is the function here. Now, these three sections of stoma that we found in components number 2, 6, and 8, all relate to the Amoraic material. Number 2 relates to Rami Bar Chama, number 6 relates to Rabbi Zeira, and number 8 relates to the two versions of Rava. But we have one other stomach component in our sugya, and that is component number 1, which is a Tzrichuta. And that is, it's a fixed Talmudic argumentation pattern, or discussion pattern, analysis pattern of our Mishnah, where it wants to know, why does our Mishnah bring us two examples of the same principle, Behema O'Kilim. And if you'll note, this Tzrichuta has nothing whatsoever to do with the Amoraic discussion in our sugya. It has to do with a stylistic issue in our Mishnah. And it's very common in Babylonian sugyas for there to be a piece of Stamat de Gemara that is placed on the Mishnah before the Amoraic sugya takes place, as it were, as a kind of an introduction of the Magid Shir, or his analysis of the Mishnah. And then, as the Amoraic sugya takes place, the Magid Shir will insert his comments of the various components of the Amoraic sugya. So whenever one pre-scans a sugya and prepares it for study, you not only scan the Amoraic material in order to determine those participating in the sugya and their generation and their Batei Midrash, but also you're going to scan the stoma sugya that's within the Amoraic sugya, and you're going to ask yourself, what does each component of stoma add to our sugya? Does it add commentary on the Amoraim, or is it a stylistic comment on the Mishnah, etc.? Okay? Are there any questions about this sugya and what I've just discussed about the stoma before we go on to sugya number 2? Please, any questions?
The first part of the sugya, the behema and kelim, is in a sense totally irrelevant to the sugya. That piece of stoma you can like fully understand the whole Mishnah without that, and you can do that without doing the rest of the Sugya. It's really like its own independent piece. Is that correct?
That's correct. And if you look at other places, for instance, at the beginning of Bava Metzia, or the beginning of Kiddushin, or many other places, you'll find similar things, only much larger, much longer. Apparently, this is the way that the Shiurim took place in the time of the Shakta Vatarya, that is, that the Magid Shiur opened with some analysis of his own, and then they dove into the Amoraic material and he analyzed that as it was brought. Are there any other questions?
So I take it, pardon me if my questions show an ignorance of last week's year because I wasn't here. But I take it that this first sugya is one which is Amoraic sugya.
That is correct. Well, that is, and tell me, but not only should your answer be correct, tell us how you figured that out, Mr. Emerson.
Well, I guess I got one hint from the fact that the very beginning is, as you said, not relevant to the rest of the material. To the, that was my hint.
Okay, but let me give you a stronger methodological grounding for your assumption. And that is that if you look at the sugya, you see that the skeletal structure of the sugya is based on Rami Bar Chama and Rava and Rabbi Zeira. And these three Amoraim are presented in chronological sequence, Rami Bar Chama being late third generation, Rava being fourth generation, and Rabbi Zeir being fifth generation. And the fact that the Amoraim and the Sugya are presented in chronological sequence is not a hint, but a direct statement that the Sugya is Amoraic. In addition, if you take the stoma of our Sugya out completely, and you leave just the Amoraim there, you have a perfectly understandable Sugya, even without the stoma. And therefore, it has all the criteria of an Amoraic Sugya. And Gary is asking, are Amoraim generally quoted in chronological order? And the answer is, this is the one issue which strictly separates between Amoraic Sugyot and Sugyot of the Shakta Vatarya. Amoraic Sugyot always have the Amoraim presented in chronological sequence. There are small exceptions to this. For instance, Rav Ashe sometimes appears out of sequence, but rarely. It's almost always in chronological sequence. Whereas Stama Sugyot in Shakta Vatarya Sugyot, the Amoraim never appear in chronological sequence, because the goal of the Stama de Gemara is to present a conceptual analysis. It's more like an essay quoting Amoraic sources, whereas the Amoraic Sugya is an Amoraic discourse with Stama commentary. So Gary, basically you put your finger on the critical issue. And when we train children how to learn Gemara, and they pre-scan the Sugya, we ask them the first thing to mark the names of the Amoraim who appear in the Sugya, to check in their indices when the Amoraim lived and where, to build the structure of the Sugya, and to determine thereby, even without any comprehension of content, whether the Sugya is an Amoraic Sugya or a Stama Sugya, and therefore to apply the correct skills, reflective skills, cognitive skills for the understanding of that type of Sugya. Are there any other questions, methodological or otherwise? Now Jay Kelman asks, don't we also have an exception for questions brought in by quoting a contradictory Amora so we can go back a couple of generations? That is, the Stama can certainly quote, within its commentary on an Amoraic Sugya, the Stama can quote an Amora which will give you the impression that it's out of sequence. But there will always be telltale signs. The Stama will quote the Amora by saying, De Amar Ploni, and that Dalit will tell you that the Amora is not part of the flow of the Sugya, he's being brought in by the Stama. And this is, of course, a more sophisticated level of scanning, is separating the Amoraim quoted by the Stama as opposed to Amoraim who are part of the skeletal structure of the Sugya. And we get to this in the training at a later date, after people have learned how to scan simple sugyas that have straight Amoraim and straight Stama.
Okay, thank you.
We have another question from Mike in Passaic. What other types of sugyot are there? Amoreik and what else? There are two basic types of sugyas in the Bavli. There's the Amoreik sugya and the Stama sugya. And we've talked about now about how they are different from each other. Within the Amoreik sugya, there are various types, as we're going to see in sugya number 2. And in the Stama sugya, there are various types of Stama sugyas. But the first and most important differentiation is Amoreik sugyas from Stama sugyas. And then within each category, there are lesser definitions. And that, I think, should answer Mike's question. Jay asks, can an Amora bring in another Amora, or does just Stama do that? And an Amora can bring in another Amora, certainly, because an Amora can say, we can have in the Gemara, Amarav Huna Amarav, we can have Amarava Amarav Nachman, we can have Amarabaye Amarava, we can have that, those kinds of chains. That's obvious. And you can also have an Amora stating his opinion and also saying, Kidde Amar, or as someone else has said. But there you see the context of what the Amor is doing. But again, these are more sophisticated levels of quotation than what we do at the first instance.
I mentioned in the length to Hatzman when Stama brings in a contradiction. Will you ever find that Amar, how can Rabbuna say that? We have what Zera says, how can Rabbuna say that? Because Rabbuna says something else. That type of an Amor brings in an Amora.
Yes, you can, although it's more likely that an Amora would bring in a Tanaitic source that way, because the fact that he brings in an Amora does not challenge an Amora, because an Amora can be Cholik on an Amora, but he would bring in a Tana, because an Amora cannot be Cholik on a Tana, according to the majority opinion of the Rishonim. Rav Chaim held that an Amora can be Cholik on a Tana, but he's a Dat Yachid, and we don't go that way today. Yes, by metive, by etive, by motive, by motive, that sort of thing. Okay, with your permission, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like us to move on to sugya number 2, because there's some important things there for us to learn methodologically as well as content-wise. If you'll open to the second sugya and you take a look at it, let's practice our scanning technique. The sugya begins, if you use your Rivadim sheets, it has... 7 components, and I'd like you to scan and determine who are the Amoraim that appear in this sugya. Who do you see here? Who is the first Amora that appears in the sugya? Yes, Paul in Baltimore says Rabbi Chia. That's right, Rabbi Chia Bar Abba, who's speaking in the name of Rabbi Yochanan. Does anyone know who Rabbi Chia Bar Abba was, or who was Rabbi Yochanan for that matter? Rabbi Yochanan was a second generation Israeli Amora, the Rosh Yeshiva in Tveria, and the Gadol Ador. Everyone who was anyone in generation 2, 3, or 4 was subservient to Rabbi Yochanan as his Talmid or his Talmid Chaver. Rabbi Chia Bar Abba was one of Rabbi Yochanan's prize pupils, and he was also one of the Nachotai who went back and forth from Eretz Yisrael to Babel. So Rabbi Chia Bar Abba is opening our sugya with the statement of Rabbi Yochanan. Who is the next Amora to appear in our sugya? Yes. Paul answers again correctly, Rav Papa. Who is Rav Papa? Rav Papa is a fifth generation Babylonian Amora. He was a Talmid of Rava, and that means that he is 3 generations later than Rabbi Yochanan, 2 generations later than Rabbi Chia Bar Abba. And after Rav Papa, who appears in the sugya? Paul, go for a hat trick. Okay, Rav Zvid says Eitan, that's correct. Generation 5, Kumbadita, and Mike from Passaic echoes Eitan's correct answer. Rav Zvid is fifth generation in Kumbadita. That is correct. So he's a friend of Rav Papa. They knew each other, they learned together, and therefore he responds to him in the sugya. And look how he responds. Rav Zvid says to him, he quotes Abaye, he says, Hachi Amar Abaye. This is what Abaye said. And he's quoting, therefore, a fourth generation Amora. There, Jay, you see an example of what you asked previously, that the Amora can quote an Amora, but only when the Amora being quoted is an authority recognized by both of those in conversation, so that the quotation has impact. Otherwise, it would not have impact. Now, take a look at the structure of this sugya, ladies and gentlemen. We have Rabbi Chiya bar Abba quoting Rabbi Yochanan, and then we have Rav Papa, and then we have Rav Zvi. We have Jay asking, what about Rava? Now, where do we have Rava? Where do we have Rava? Where does he appear, Jay?
He appears in the Ika de Amrei by 7, which, of course, is the reasoning character. I'm just by pointing that out. In other words, he's not part of the flow of the Sugya. He's, without even knowing the Sugya, he's a second tradition they have in how to learn the Sugya, the Ika de Amrei part.
Yes, that is correct. That is correct. And so he's not part of the actual flow of our Sugya. But where do you see him exactly? Give us the component number so that everyone will know what you're talking about.
I have to look. I go back from here to the other screen. Hold on. Between 7 and 8, the way you have it set up.
There is no 8. You're looking at the first sugya, Jay. We're looking at sugya 2 now.
Hold on, I am. Hold on.
The second sugya ends with 7 chet.
I have some like flashy stuff on my screen, but I'm definitely looking at the same sugya you are. I thought it's on 8, but okay, go on.
But as Gary Levine says, it certainly would have been pleasant to hear from Rava, but what can you do? All right, he didn't appear here. Now, anyway, let's look at the structure of this sugya. So this is, we have Rabbi Chiya bar Abba and Rabbi Yochanan. That's Eretz Yisrael Dika Torah, right? Then we have fifth generation Babylonian Torah, Rav Papa and Rav Zvi. Now, how does this sugya differ from the sugya that we studied in number one, which was Rami Bar Chama and Rava and Rabbi Zera? Who would like to tell me what the difference is between the structure of the two sugyot? Jay says geography. Paul says later rabbis. Peter Beauregard from Berkeley says dislocated in time and space. Time and place. Okay. Well, I don't think we don't have to go too far. We can just say that Rabbi Bar Chama and Rabbi Zera were all from the same Beis Medrash. That is, they all knew each other. It was a single Beis Medrash Babylonian sugya. You see that? It's an Amoraic sugya, but all the Amoraim know each other, and they're in chronological sequence, and they're all from the same place. They're all from the same Beit Midrash. It's a simple sugya, but. And just a minute, Gary, I'll discuss why it's significant in just a minute. But in the second sugya, they're not from the same Beit Midrash. We have two components in the sugya, Amoraic components, an Israeli component and a Babylonian component. We still have chronological sequence, but we have dislocation of place. Now, why is this so important? It's important because context. Now, Eitan asked, does this mean the stoma put this together? No, not at all. The stoma is another level on top of it. What happened was, the sugya started in Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Chiya bar Abba heard Rabbi Yochanan say what he said in Tveria. He traveled to Babylonia. He then met in Babylonia. He met Talmidei Chachamim there, most likely in Pumbedita. And there his Torah was, as it were, deprogrammed. And then it became part of the Babylonian discourse, and it was commented on by Talmidim of the fifth generation. So in other words, it wasn't that's perfectly, that accumulated perfectly organically in the Amoraic period. And then, on top of all of this, the Stama comes and comments on it. So the Stama is a third and later layer. Now the reason, going back to Gary's question, why this is so significant, is because context, the ability to maintain perfect context, is dependent on how close the participants in the discussion are to each other in time and in place. That is, in a natural Amoraic Sugya, where all the Amoraim are sitting around talking with each other, and they're all from the same generation or one generation apart, there is highly unlikely that there ever would be any problem of context, because they're all right there with each other. When Amoraic Torah goes from one Beis Medrash to the other, then you within one country, then you have a certain possibility of context problems, as we know from a sugya that we're going to study later on in this perek, because different Bati Medrash had slightly different ways of thinking and learning. But when you have Torah that goes internationally, that goes from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel, or goes from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael, then the context problems are potentially much greater, because the culture is different, the languages are different, the way of thinking and learning is very different, and therefore students of Talmud would have to be very careful when they do their pre-scanning of a sugya before content, as we just did, not to to miss the implications of multiple batei midrash in a sugya or multiple countries in a sugya. And then the Amoraic sugya then has to be laid out and according to its component pieces, and students need to learn each piece separately and then ask, okay, now what is the next unit from the other next Beit Midrash or the next country add to what I had originally? And after that is done within the Amoraic Sugya, then and only then would you then ask, now what is the Stamma de Gemara add on top of the entire Amoraic package, which was put together before the Stamma began? Okay? Are there any questions on this point of method before we go into the content of the sugya?
Well, if I may, there's not a halachic significance. What you're explaining is just to see the flow of the sugya to understand it better, but for the other case, would that be halachically significant?
Well, that depends what you mean by halachically significant. If we're talking about halacha in our day, then of course there's no significance, because the Gemara, the Bavli as a whole, was accepted by Klal Yisrael, and we don't paskin from the Gemara today. We paskin from the Shulchan Aruch. Great Talmidei Chachamim like Rav Soloveitchik used to paskin from the Rishonim directly, but it has the whether we read the sugya like this or like that has no halakhic significance today in that respect. But if you're asking about halakhic significance within the sugya, you're asking about how the halakha developed within the sugya until the point where the Bavli became a closed document accepted by Klal Yisrael, then it has great significance, because the concepts develop from place to place and from generation to generation. And after all, what we're after in the Rivadim Shita is to try to make the sugya a three or even a four-dimensional model, so we can see process and not only product. And that can only be done when we can determine who is from where and from when. Now, Gary Levine is asking, so methodologically, he's asking, would this be a distinction you would make to students just beginning, or something more appropriate for more experienced students? Well, when we begin to speak with students, we start with simple sugyas, that is, natural sugyas of Amoraim speaking to each other. Then we go to what's called edited sugyas, which is where the Amoraim are not speaking to each other, but they have accumulated over a number of generations within a single Beit Midrash. And after students understand that structure, then we would go on to sugyas that have accumulated in multiple Batei Midrash. And only after that would we go on to sugyot that have accumulated in multiple Batei Midrash in Israel and in Bavel. So that we're gradually helping students grow from simple sugyot to the most complex sugyot in an orderly way. So I would say at the very beginning, but it may be at the beginning of a ninth grade class, for instance, then we would begin with simple sugyas. But by the end of ninth grade, children should be able to scan all of these different types of sugyas spontaneously and recognize them without any problem, and therefore be able to reflectively strategize in their minds how to learn a given sugya before they know even one word of the content. Now, Dov Weinstein from Brooklyn is asking, do you have a suggestion for a good list of Tanas and Amoras and their generations and locations? Well, you should, you should excuse me for giving the advertisement. If you go on to the Bonaic website, you'll see a beautiful product called Otsar HaDemuyot, which is a database that we put together exactly for this purpose. It's not expensive, and you can buy it, order it from us. It comes with a booklet for use on Shabbos and Yom Tov when you can't use the database. It's user-friendly, and it's the most up-to-date and scientific instrument of its kind in the world. And Stanley is asking from Toronto, am I going to proceed in the same manner with you? The purpose of these six lessons over the airwaves is to study several signals together so you can see what are the implications and the relevance of the method that I'm trying to teach. And what might be a suggestion, we can mention this to Rabbi Kelman, is that maybe we should do a beginning course over the airwaves at some later time in the next round. Maybe we can do something like that. But in the meantime, Stanley, maybe just pick up on these methodological points and you'll start putting them together on your own, as I see that you already have been in our initial study. All right, let's go to the second sugya now, and let's see what is going on in this international edited Amoraic sugya on the level of the Amoraim, and only after that will we go to the Stama sugya. Any other questions before I do that?
I'd like to ask a question, Gary.
Yes, Gary, please go ahead.
Thank you. Again, for giving a methodological question. The assumption, based on how you're presenting this, is that in teaching this to beginning students and then more and more advanced, the course has to be designed in terms of sugyot. One could not do this in a course in which we began at the beginning of a parak and just did the whole parak, because we would run across a sugya which has something like this in it, which is not yet appropriate to beginners. Is that the assumption in the process?
That's a very good question. However, you could do it that way, but because there is a value in the organic learning of a perek, not only in the study of individual sugyot, the way that we generally recommend is that if, let's say, students have four lessons a week or five lessons a week of Talmud, or even three lessons a week, that part of the time be used for the systematic study of the methodology, and the balance of the time, which should be slightly more than 50%, should be used to study content either in sugyot or in an organic perek, applying the skills learned in the systematic study of the methodology. That is, that skills construction has to work along an independent axis than learning Kaseder, because there are very they're very different, as you most correctly noted. And this is what we're already doing in a number of schools, and we find it to be very successful. Peter is asking from Berkeley, are there some prakim that are particularly good to start with? I would say that there are, it's best to start with prakim that are overwhelmingly amoraic and have a minority of stamasugyas, which are more difficult and more complex. And Hamafkid is a good parak to begin with for that purpose, and so is the second and third parak of Kiddushin, the third parak more than the second. And there are other prakim as well that are worth learning that way. But the most important thing that I can stress is that whatever parak you learn, it's absolutely critical to be in some sort of framework where you are learning the methodology systematically. In the same way that in mathematics, one learns mathematics systematically with arithmetic and then algebra and then geometry and then trigonometry and then physics, one wouldn't learn them out of order. And the same thing with English. There's simple sentences and complex sentences that one must learn in every discipline. One must learn the methodology of the discipline systematically and in order, while at the same time experiencing organic creations of the discipline in a natural way. So this kind of complements, one complements the other. Other questions? All right, let's go into the content. Let's look at component number one in sugya number two. Amar Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, lo shilem, shilem mamash, ela kevan she'amar hareini mishalem, af al pi shelo shilem. What is Rabbi Yochanan relating to? Because his statement is obviously interpretive. What is he interpreting? He's quoting from where?
Rabbi
He's quoting from our Mishnah. Because, yes, the Mishnah, Dov, that's correct. That is correct. And Paul says the verb is in the past tense, and that's strange. What, Shilein? Well, look in our Mishnah, the second line of our Mishnah at the beginning of Sugya number 1, where it says, Shilein velo ratza li shava, shahare amru shomer chinam nishpa v'yotzei. So when it says, if he paid and did not want to swear, the guardian paid the owner for his loss and didn't want to take an oath. So Rabbi Yochanan is saying, he's quoting Shilein from the Mishnah. That's why it's in past. So he's saying, lo Shilein, Shilein mamash. The Mishnah doesn't mean that he physically paid, that there was transfer from one bank account to the other of the funds. But when he said, Hareini Mishalem, when he says, I am going to pay, I accept responsibility to pay you, even if he has not yet actually paid him, then he's acquired the double damages by his obligation to pay. And I'll give you an example of this. I was doing a chuppah some years ago, and under the chuppah, as we normally do, I asked the chatan, when he brought the ring out to give to his kala, is this ring yours? Did you buy this with your own money and pay for it? To which the chatan responded, well, yes and no. And I, turning slightly pale, said, what do you mean by yes and no? He said, well, I bought it with a credit card, but I haven't paid the bill yet. So in that case, it's exactly like our sugya. He's taken on an obligation to pay for the ring, but he hasn't paid for it as of yet. And that's called payment. Right, so therefore, what Rabbi Chiya is saying in the name of Rabbi Yochanan is that obligation to pay has the same effect as payment. And as Jay noted in one of his previous remarks there on the screen, this has great implications for the payment of the double damages. Because when the thief is found, he's going to pay double damages. Is this before or after the guardian accepted obligation to pay? So this is a very important point Rabbi Yochanan is making. Now, where does Rabbi Yochanan get this from? Are there any suggestions? Where does Rabbi Yochanan? This is a tremendous chiddush in the Mishnah, because the Mishnah says shilein, that he paid. So Jay says ratza velo ratza li shava, that is. That it lo ratza li shava is in past tense. That is, he paid because he did not want to swear. What? Dov asking, so did they get married? What? Who is the guardian and the owner? Oh, you mean the chatan and kala? Yeah, they got married. Everything was okay. Everything was fine. Yeah, I've got worse stories from weddings than that. We'll get into them sometime. But anyway, wanting, not actually doing. That Shilein Lo Ratza Li Shava means he wanted to pay, he didn't want to swear. That's a good deal, Jay, because the Ratza you're saying actually is going on both. But if he didn't pay his visa bill at any time, no, it wouldn't matter, Gary, because once he accepts obligation to pay, it's as if he's paid because the obligation could be taken from him or from his estate at any given time. It's as good as writing a check in that regard. All right, but we don't know where Rabbi Yochanan gets this from. Jay has made a good suggestion that he gets it from the language of the Mishnah. And the Stama wants to know this as well, and that's what lies behind the Stama's inquiry in component number 2 and in component number 3. But we'll do those after we've done the Amorei Sugya. Let's move on. Rav Papa, in generation 5 in Babel, has received Rabbi Yochanan, and look what he says. And take note that in component number 4, Rav Papa's Memra is 3 lines. And interspersed in between the 3 lines of Rav Papa's Memra are lines of Stama de Gemara giving us the explanation or the rationale of Rav Papa's remarks. So Rav Papa says, Eitan is saying, language alert. Why is Rav Papa saying things in Aramaic? It complicates the scanning since there is no distinction between Amorek statement and Stama. Well, that's a very good point you're making, Eitan. As a matter of fact, here I would have to say that you caught us red-handed, because really, Rav Papa didn't say those Aramaic words, and they should be in the Stama font. Rav Papa said, Shomer chinam kevan she'amar pashati, Shomer sachar kevan she'amar nigneva, Shoel shomer hareini mishalem. But the statements mitmilek feda at the end of this of the his sentences, you are correct. They are not amoreic. They belong to the stomach. Well done, Eitan. Well done. Now, what is Rav Papa saying? He's saying shomer chinam kevan sheamar pashati. That is that the Rav Papa is saying that a guardian who is guarding for free, the minute he says pashati, he doesn't even have to say hareni mishalem, because the minute he says pashati, then he is obligated to pay. So the minute he accepts responsibility for what happened, whether he explicitly states obligation to pay or not, is quite irrelevant. And similarly for a shomer sakar, the minute he says nigneva, because a shomer sakar is liable for theft of the animal, then and therefore requires the double damage. And Mike is asking Shomer say it to. And the answer is he says it to the either to the court or he says it to the owner of the object. And it goes on in his last statement, Shoel Shomer Harmeni Mishalem, that when a borrower says Harmeni Mishalem, then he also can acquire the damages. However, addition, Papa mean about the Shoel. Okay? And Jay's asking, Jay's telling me I have a 5-minute warning. Well, now what I want to suggest that we all do for homework for next time is that you read through again this sugya, which are Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, Rav Papa, Rav Papa's Ika de Amrei in component number 5, and Rav Zvid's remark in the name of Abaye in component number 6, and see if you can put together what is the flow of the Amoreic Sugya. And after that is done, then try and go back and learn the stomach components of the Sugya on your own and see if you can figure out what the stomach is adding to the Amoreic Sugya. Stanley is asking from Toronto, why is Rav Papa's 3 statements so terse? Why did they leave out the consequences? And the answer is, that's a very good question, and the answer is because Rav Papa was speaking in the context of a discussion of Rabbi Yochanan's remark. And so since Rabbi Yochanan said, Lo shilem shilem mamash, elekevan shemar harini mishalem, apopi shalo shilem, then everyone knows what's being discussed. And where Papa says, Shomer chinam kevan shemar pashati, he's just basically continuing Rabbi Yochanan's context. And therefore he doesn't have to state the eventual consequences because they are obvious. The other thing is, remember that the students of the Amoraim wanted to formulate the statements of their teachers in as terse a Hebrew statement as possible so that it could be learned by heart and mastered as easily as possible. Okay, so this is our lesson for this evening. And it was a pleasure being with you. I think you're all catching on. In the immortal words of my fair lady, I think she's got it. And we will be continuing next week, and if there are no further questions, I'm going to sign off from beautiful downtown Elkanah.